The county's number one talk show, the 9 till noon show on Highland Radio.
And you're very welcome back to the programme. Good morning if you're just joining us, 12 minutes past 10 on this Monday, the 30th of January 2023. And just a word for you if you're listening to us on our pod, on the website or on playback overnight, that you can always get involved in the conversation, by the way, if you email comments at highlandradio.com or WhatsApp or text the show on 086 60 25000. Well, then we can pick up your comments for broadcast on the next morning show. Hi, Greg. In relation to the nursing home charges, is it the Fair Deal ones that were scammed, or can anyone claim back that the families in nursing homes? I'm learning about this story as we go at the moment. I can't answer that question for certainty. I don't think it's associated necessarily with the Fair Deal scheme, but we are going to be covering it, so stay tuned. Tell Charlie McConnell, Oak, we the people are not that easy fooled nowadays. Fitting better to get better quotas for the fishermen. Morning, Greg. I just want to warn people heading from Upper Ashlawn down to Lower Ashlawn that there is a tree felling going on in Lower Ashlawn and you won't get through. Also, there's no warning signs to let drivers know what's ahead. Okay. In the last week, the Shore Green and other green areas in and around Buncrana have been vandalised too. Right, okay, that's regrettable. That's off the back of an appeal from Buncrana Golf Club, a beautiful golf club, actually. And beautiful, well, really well maintained, that someone went up there, two guys on an electric scooter, and destroyed the eighth green, a kind of a showcase green, I think it is, in any case. And it's destroyed now, and it takes ages to get it back up to its original condition. The golf club has said, look, we know who you are, probably. We don't want to necessarily have to get the Gardaí involved. Contact us before the end of today. And they won't release the footage or contact the Gardaí, or at least they'll keep those options open, I think. I don't want to say that categorically. But now we're getting other people saying that other green areas of Buncrana are being vandalised or have been vandalised too, which is very regrettable. There's a lot of sheep, 30-odd sheep on the road between Brockett and Clohan. So if you're travelling on that road between Brockett and Clohan, keep an eye out. 30-odd sheep on the road there. I wonder if this newly uncovered scandal about government covering up their top secret complicit fraud against families is just the tip of the iceberg, and why the establishment are terrified of Fine Gael, Fianna Fáil, Greens and Labour being rooted routed at the next general election and replaced by those who've nothing to lose but a better, less corrupt and competent government in Ireland. I think there are those from within that suggest that such a strategy as seems to have been employed here to save... having to pay these families the money they're entitled to might be a strategy that's employed in other areas. The concert for Chrysler tonight is to be aired on TG Cahir tonight live. Okay, didn't know that. Good to hear. When booking flights, always use your credit card, not your debit card. If you spend the debit card, the money's yours and gone, whereas the credit card company will chase up the payment and you don't have to. I think you have some protection with debit card, but I understand what you're saying. Credit card better. Not everyone has credit cards, though. That's the thing. Hi, Greg. When I booked a holiday and the company went bust overnight, I can't remember the details, but I do remember I got refunded through the Commission of Aviation. Might help that woman. Indeed, we've put her on to the CAA. .co.uk, and we hope that she gets that refund, which is rightfully hers, of course. A quick mention of our Highland Fling in Glasgow, the campaign for me to be in attendance. I'm not going to lie, it's ground to a halt now at this point. I don't think it's going to happen, but that doesn't matter whether I'm there or not, because you can be there. And there's been a great deal of interest in this, by the way, and I've seen sort of similar type things of this that aren't for as long and aren't as far away and not far off the same kind of price point as well. So it represents good value in this day and age. It's from the 1st to the 4th of May. You're staying at the 4-star Crown Plaza Hotel in Glasgow, and the package includes 4-star accommodation in the Crown Plaza I mentioned, breakfast and dinner, which are the two important meals. I don't really eat lunch, to be honest with you. I'd be last down to the breakfast and then I'd have me dinner. I probably wouldn't have lunch, but you can, of course. Breakfast and dinner, entertainment each evening, and, which I think is really important here, luxury coach transport. Travel for me is a lot of the hassle. Here, you get on the coach here at Highland and we drop you off at the hotel. Then we pick you up and you bring you back. There's loads of time during the day to explore Glasgow. The hotel's quite centrally placed. If you've got friends and family in Glasgow, they can come along at the night. There's walk-up tickets available and join you for the crack as well. On the 1st of May, David James is... operating a dance, he and the Ryan Turner Band. On Tuesday the 2nd of May, there's a concert with Declan Nerney and more. Declan Nerney's a the real class act, isn't he? As well as David, of course. But Declan's been on the circuit a long time now. Wednesday, the 3rd, Robert Mazzell to another headliner. And there's loads of other guests as well. Sinead Black's involved and many others as well. It's £5.75 per person and everything's covered there by whatever you fancy doing yourself. If you're interested, €100 will secure your place today. Right, okay, so you can think about how you pay the £4.75 between now and departure date. But €100 books your ticket today. And as I say, tickets for this are going really fast, which is great because apparently it's great fun. And people make new friends or reacquaint themselves with old friends that have been on these trips before. And as I say, loads of people already booking. So it will sell out. So if you're thinking about it and you have the 100 to spare today, I would get on it. Call us on 07491 25000 with any questions, by the way. You don't have to ring and book. If you've got some questions or queries, things that I haven't mentioned, we're able to pass them on to you. Okay, you're very welcome back to the 9 till noon show here on Highland Radio. And we're joined in studio now by Jane Buckley, author of Stone's Corner. And we're on volume 3 now. Good morning to you. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me. Delighted to be here.
Okay, tell us about this series of books, Jane.
Well, I decided in 2017, just I suddenly decided one...
Well, that microphone seems to have drifted
from
your
face. Oh, sorry. Have I moved?
You have.
You got me? You got me. I just decided to write a book. I've always been a reader, and New Year's Day, I think it was in 2017, I thought I'd write a book. I told my husband, who laughed, and maybe, you know...
We're always very supportive.
Well, absolutely. I mean, he did. He laughed. But it was just something that I just wanted to do, and I'm a bit of a completer finisher, and it turns out the one book has turned into three.
And they've been really, really well received.
They have.
Too,
and
she's you never know, do you?
No.
Because you have this idea and you don't know, well, will it resonate? Will, you know?
It's been overwhelming. I mean, it really has. I mean, at the beginning, it was a bit difficult because around 2017, 2018, before, I guess, Dairy Girls and some of the sort of the films and the TV programs had been coming out based around the Troubles. You know, I was told quite categorically, no, not interested, nothing to do with the Troubles, we're just not interested in it. So that was one of the reasons I decided to go down the self-publishing route. And I'm not getting any younger, so I thought, well, let's just do it.
Well, you're not terribly old either, so
well,
you can't use that as an excuse.
Oh, you should have seen me this morning.
But you thought, look, the time is right in my life now for me to do this.
Absolutely.
And you really went to town in it. So we're going to talk about the self-publishing process too, because I think that's really quite important. But... have you had any feedback from those that knocked you back and yet you've proven that, no, you were going to produce something that covered a particular topic but was done in such a way that people wanted to consume it?
No, I haven't really, because what I've decided to do is, I mean, I treat these books as a product. I mean, I run my writing as a business. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure I'll ever make much money out of it. Sorry, John, that's my husband who lent me the money. But I think one of the things that I've been quite overwhelmed with is the target audience originally was the younger generation. I wanted to try and tell them through a series of fictional stories based around true events, but thrilling stories. I mean, there's lots of plots and twists. They're not easy books to read. I mean, they're hard-hitting. But what I find is the majority of the readers are actually, you know, in their mid-50s, have actually lived through the Troubles and actually have embraced some of the sort of the topics that I've covered because it actually resonates with them. But again, one of the things that's interesting, a lot of the Republic, you know, Republic readers from Dublin and further south, a lot of the feedback, you know, I've seen and from reviews have said they never truly understood exactly what it was like to live through the Troubles up here. They were probably, to a certain extent, protected from it per se, but they thoroughly enjoyed it. And so the plan is I'll finish the fourth book this year, and then I will, from the feedback that I've had, from the reviews, from the followers, I will be in a better, you know, good stead to approach publishers and say, right, I can, you know, I've proven it, I've done it, I've completed it.
And would that be to produce new work or to have these reissued?
Reissued through a publisher. I mean, I'm actually looking at redesigning the cover, for example. I mean, I've learned so much through the self-publishing; it's unbelievable. So it's a matter of just doing another edition. And I haven't, you know, when I look at the first book, for example, I start to read it and there's things I'd like to change, which I think is something that writers do all the time. They're never happy with the final product. But
I'm not sure they want you to stop changing
things. No, I know, exactly. And it's work. Why break something when it's working?
So, they are fiction, right? Yes. Okay. But you say they're based on real stories.
Yes.
Now, are they sort of a correlation of stories that we're probably quite familiar with, typical kind of stories, if such a thing exists, and then you dramatise them and fictionalise it? Or did you speak to individuals of these stories that you have personal knowledge of? If you understand, I'm not being clumsy with the question.
No, not at all. I mean, I'll give you a little bit of a synopsis in the story. I mean, the first book is based around a shirt factory in Derry and the survival of a shirt factory. It's owned by a young Protestant who comes to the city, who's quite naive and probably a little bit arrogant, but he's determined to keep the factory open. And then we've got a young British soldier from Newcastle who comes across, who joined the British Army, like many did, because there was no work. The shipyards were closing in Newcastle. So it's from his experience, too, as to what, you know, after the honeymoon period, what it was like for him to, you know, what happens to him personally and through friends, you know, being in, serving in the North. And then you've got a, you know, you've got a protagonist who's a staunch unionist, and from his perspective too. So what I've tried to do is be as, you know, unbiased as I possibly could be by telling the stories through. I mean, for example, I did interview a British soldier, and I did watch a lot of, you know, YouTube interviews about serving soldiers at that time. To get a sense of what their life was like. Because, you know, depending on who you were, each of us had different experiences growing up through the Troubles. So it was trying to tell a story from each perspective.
You're on volume three now, working on volume four.
Yeah.
Turmoil, Darkness and Light are the three editions out at the moment. Are they continuations of the same story? Do we have a crossover of characters?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it's a tetralogy, as it's called, but absolutely. There's, you know, you've got the main core characters, three or four main core characters. I mean, Turmoil starts in 1972, just after Bloody Sunday. Darkness goes into the mid-70s, which was probably, the, you know, especially across in England, for example, was the worst years for the atrocities that happened in England. Light is coming into the early 80s, and then finally Hope will be leading up to the Good Friday Agreement, you know, 1996.
So there's a bit of responsibility here in what you're doing, in that I suppose you have to accurately timeline things and sort of capture where things were at what time, and that it feels like, yeah, that's really what it was like.
Yeah.
But also, too, when you're talking about members of different communities involved, and when you're talking about trying to represent someone who was a soldier, for example, or other soldiers, there is, you have to be careful there. It's a maze that you're trying to get through there. Do you, as much as you can, because no matter what anyone does, you'll always have detractors and critics, but do you think you've struck those balances well? Are you satisfied with how you've done that?
I mean, I've worked really, really hard at doing that through a lot of research.
It doesn't matter, I think, don't much if you're in France reading this, or if you're in Canada, or if you're in Australia, but if you're sitting in Derry or Donegal or maybe to a lesser extent Dublin, then it probably matters a bit more.
Yeah, I mean, undoubtedly, and I think that's from the reviews, that's one of the core messages that are coming out, the fact that they have been very evenly balanced. Because, and again, this is the advantage of doing self-published, is that I have been able to write it in my own words. And I mean, I did grow, you know, I grew up through the Troubles. Mm-hmm. You know, I lived in a Republican
council
estate.
You're not from the outside watching in.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So, I mean,
it's your story too, really, effectively.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, it's I've been able to be more sensitive. And it is a very fine line. So, and I make sure that I have sort of four or five readers that,
but at the same time, you have to be brave sometimes to say, right, okay, this I might upset people in this chapter, but hopefully they'll understand in the round. You have to have a bit of bravery in that regard too, I imagine.
No, you're totally right. I mean, there's one or two chapters in there that people have told me they've had to put the book down because it really is quite descriptive and raw. But
which will infuriate or upset or evoke different types of emotion. That's what art does, isn't it?
Well, I mean, then that's the whole thing. That's why I thoroughly love being, I embrace that challenge as well. I embrace the challenge of actually putting things in and describing things.
And your readers in the feedback, do they recognise the story you're telling, if you know what I mean? Do you get people say, you're telling my story here to some extent, obviously? Not everyone's been through the nitty-gritties of it, but just how you present life.
Yeah. I mean, I was quite moved. I was at Dingle Literature Festival there just before Christmas, and I actually did a reading from one of the scenes, a bomb, where a bomb goes off in Shipley Street. And one of the ladies that was there, you know, she took me aside and she said that she had been in Dublin, you know, during the Monaghan Dublin bombs. And how I actually described it was precisely she was back there. So yeah. It is very, very descriptive. And, you know, when I hear something like that, it's actually quite emotive. You get quite sort of, oh, my goodness, because this is real life. This is real events and real emotions and everything. Yeah. The legacy of it still exists.
So, I mean, obviously, you've mentioned some of the timelines that this series of books covers. Do you stick to that? So say there was a particular shooting or an event or an arrest or an explosion. Yeah. Do you intertwine? So in other words, how much does this reflect things that actually happened?
Oh, very, very much so. I mean, I've used the Kane reports that you get from Ulster University, and they literally, year by year, have a day by day timeline. Wow. So there's a lot of things in there, you know, things that people can, that have been so easily missed, you know, like, you know, not, dare I say it, not smaller events, but, you know, really heartbreaking events.
I understand what you mean in that, and it's hard to describe, but I do know what you're saying. Stuff that doesn't necessarily live in people's minds all of the time, outside of those that were directly affected
by
it. Okay.
Absolutely.
So, to some extent, and maybe it's not the intention, for someone outside of Ireland, right outside of Britain, listen, let's forget it, this is very fresh in the mind for a lot of people over there as well, then to some extent will they learn of the Troubles, then, the history of Northern Ireland over the decades that you've dedicated these books to. And wrapped around that, then, is these fictional characters living real life stories, effectively.
Yeah, I mean, that was the whole the purpose was, for want of a better word, to educate, because I was very fortunate. You know, I did a lot of traveling. I've traveled all over the world, and time again, people, you know, what was it all about? You know, why did it last so long? And I really get sick and I just get fed up with people asking me the questions. So I thought, well, by doing a fictional story, you know, of characters, I thought, you know, it's a good read, but you're learning at the same time, you know, you're educating. And again, you know, you look at the reviews and people say, I never knew that had happened. Yeah. I knew I'd never heard, you know.
So when you have approached publishers, I kind of get maybe where they're coming from. I think people are kind of exhausted to some extent. And it's not just this, you see, with other issues, injustices often around the world, where there's a lot of stuff has been done and people, you know, people don't have the emotional capacity to go through it again through another form. So you were kind of pushed back for kind of those reasons.
That reason. Okay. It's purely for the fact that it was based in the Troubles.
So then what made you persist? What made you... Because I presume at that point, you know, there are people saying to you, well, these guys, you know, they're in the business. They know what they've got. They know what's selling. They know this. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
People might around you might have, in a very positive way, tried to discourage you, if you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Because you don't want you to waste your time and efforts and all that kind of stuff. So despite all of that, you continued. What made you continue?
Pure stubbornness. I mean, and determination. I just felt I wanted to get the stories out, you know. The fourth book, I have, at the moment, you know, I was awake at 3 o'clock this morning, my head spinning with all these characters. They're all asking me what's going to happen next and where they're going to go. But I just, I liked, it's important to me to prove to myself that I can do it. And this is why I've embraced this. I love doing it. But I would also say to anybody who wants to write a book, it is really quite cathartic as well in doing it and getting it out of your system. You know, who knows where these books are going to go? Yeah. I mean, I can't work any harder than what I've done on them. But I truly believe, you know, if you're doing something you love, then, you know, call it fate. You know, it'll take off. And again, if you think how many books they're published every year, through traditional publishers, there's just under 200,000 books in the UK published every year. And then there's me. You know, so it's all a matter of just pure believing in what you're doing. And I truly believe in these stories, and I believe in the characters, I believe in the message. And I really want people to read and enjoy and learn.
All right, I was chatting to Jane Buckley, who's the author of Stone Corner. She's self-published three books so far, working on her fourth. So how tough is it then to get a book? You know, you write it, right? Okay, so someone has to read over it too as well, presumably.
Yeah.
Is that how it works?
Yeah.
advice on formatting and stuff. I don't know. You have to go to a printing factory. You know, you have to design this.
Yeah, well, I mean...
So, like, that sounds like a bridge, a hill I wouldn't climb, but is it as tough as it sounds?
It is tough.
And I'm only talking about the highlights here.
No, it is tough. I mean, and again, there's lots of lessons learned, but, you know, I took a chunk of money out of my pension and I paid for a professional editor. I mean, the process is, I would write a chapter. I've been fortunate. I can write about 2,000 words a day when I put my mind to it. John would check the chapter, give me feedback, and then I would obviously work on getting the final. And they're big books. I mean, they're 135,000 words. You know, that's 9 hours of reading. 9 hours on audio, because I was looking at doing audio. But, you know, I've got a professional editor, a copywriter, who's actually based in Christchurch in New Zealand. So I have a process now.
There's no corners cut in that regard, but
you have
to do it yourself.
Oh, you do.
And source these people.
You do. And, you know, especially if it's self-published, it's got to be 200%. Because there's a lot of... Quite frankly, there's a lot of work out there that's self-published work that isn't up to standard. And then obviously there is a feeling that if you've self-published, you're not taken as seriously as you would be a traditional publisher.
Are we still at that point?
I feel we are. I mean, there's a number of big competitions that if you're self-published author, they won't touch you, like Ampost, any of the credible ones. But more and more as time goes on, I mean, the number of books that have been self-published since 2010 has gone up by something like 246%.
And listen, there are some people that do back the whole self-publishing area, but you kind of have to flog it yourself.
That's the hardest thing. Yeah.
You know, and even you almost sell your soul to get on to plug it, really.
Yeah,
kind of a thing,
yeah,
you know,
and
what I mean?
Not many,
which probably feeds into this hierarchy of publishing companies versus self-published.
Truly, absolutely. And I mean, fortunately, my background has been sales and marketing, so I've got that sort of steel enamel, whatever, you know, I can take it. But a lot of authors find that really, really difficult. But I just, you know, I'm having a ball.
What do you think needs to change, if anything, then? Because at the end of the day, publishing companies are, you know, they're profit driven. Yeah. They're private companies. They can make their own decisions.
Yeah.
There are pathways now, the same with music, you know, where people can record their own music, make their own videos, post it themselves on YouTube, put it up on Spotify, iTunes. Does anything need to change, or... is this just the way it's going to be for those who find themselves having to self-publish?
No, I don't think anything's good. I think it's changed so much, and I think COVID certainly had a huge effect on it. Yeah. I think, you know, the number of people that found they had hobbies they never knew they could do, or, you know, they discovered talents that they didn't have, and writing definitely was one of them. I mean, people still prefer, something like 80% of people still prefer a hardback or a paperback book.
It is. Sales of paperbacks
in Ireland
are
especially
increasing.
I mean, they are increasing, absolutely. So, you know, there's always going to be a want for books.
Of course. Well, listen, obviously, we had this conversation with a bookstore owner not so long ago. There was this fear that the Kindle, isn't it?
Yeah, Kindle.
Would kill off the book.
Yeah.
But people want the smell, the feel,
no,
the physical.
There's no better feeling in the world than, you know, having a book in your hand and just disappearing into a corner.
Yes.
You know, but with people are time poor, you know, and with audiobooks as well, you know, they are definitely increasing.
Don't work for me, or podcasts.
No, but they're not for everybody.
I fall asleep five minutes
absolutely.
In and I'm gone.
No, you're right. They fit me
the
asleep.
Amount of podcasts I've started, you know, and not all at night time.
No, I know.
And 10 minutes in.
Yeah, your head, you fall asleep three
times, and then that's never to go back again. How often can you restart the same podcast?
I know. And
I love true crime stuff as well. But I've found I can't even listen to them now when I'm driving.
Yeah.
Because I've got this muscle memory of sleep.
No, it's true. It's true. And you sort of, your mind sort of wanders off anyway, doesn't it?
So. I think maybe because this is what I do, then that's my switch off. And it's not through boredom, by the way. It's pure relaxation because it empties the mind.
Yeah.
In terms of how you sell the books, then obviously you've got a background in marketing. You're going to be using, you know, social media, online markets and that kind of stuff. Amazon, for example, you know, we talked about how they're Spotify, you're very easy to put a song up on Spotify. If you want to flog stuff on Amazon, is that tough?
Amazon works beautifully when it works.
Okay.
I mean, it really is. It's an amazing platform. But my books have been taken off Amazon.
Really?
They were taken off on the 21st of December. I have actually written to the UK country manager, a guy called John. I've written his name down somewhere. I have no idea where they've been taken off. I keep getting the same generic response, and I have decided, you know, because it really...
Is it like community guidelines or something?
Oh, it's something to do. I mean, they want the monopoly. There's no doubt about it. I mean, if you put your books on Amazon, you're not allowed to put them on into any other sort of platform.
Right. So your own website?
Well, even on your own website. And I think that's... What frustrates me is I had the best quarter last year, leading up to Christmas. So what they've done is they've taken them off the...
pulled the rug from
platform.
Underneath.
They've kept the royalties. Right. I must have sent them something like 18 emails asking them to explain to me why.
Frustrating.
And nothing. Absolutely
nothing. Do
you think
that they've been flagged as propaganda or something?
No, I don't think. Well, you know, that did cross my mind.
That being said, you know, Alex Jones's books are up
there,
right? Okay,
yeah.
So I don't think this... We're not in that territory.
No, thank
why,
God.
Maybe book four.
No. It could be.
It couldn't be community guidelines then.
I honestly, I don't know. This is the problem.
Wow,
they won't tell me. I mean, I had an email there last week just saying, this is our final, you know, this is our final decision. It will not be changed. So what I've decided to do is, because I really did get myself, especially self-publishing, it makes such a difference having them. Everybody expects your books to be on Amazon.
Of course, because that is within the self-publishing.
Of
that's
course,
the mark of success,
is,
I suppose, isn't
yeah.
it?
But I can...
And
I mean,
reviews and ratings.
Yeah.
And is there other books of a similar name?
Pardon?
Is there
no,
other
no, okay. Not at all. But I mean, I've got the e-books on my website, janebuckleywrites.com, so I can sell the e-books myself. You can get the paper copies on my website, order and pay for them as well. You know, they're in Bookmark and Letterkenny. You know, they're in Little Acorns and Derry. So just Google Jane Buckley and they'll come up. So I've decided to let it go. They can go away and I'll find
Hold
something else.
Hold on a second.
Huh?
Stubborn Jane wouldn't let things go.
Oh, you know what? You know, I looked at some of the things, you know.
I have one explanation. I'd let it go if I had an explanation.
I don't know. I honestly don't know. But I've looked at it. I did a bit of research even just yesterday evening. It's not just me. It happens to an awful lot of authors and they're all as frustrated as
okay.
I am.
Right, so you're
so
one of
It's
many
not
then.
Just me.
Okay,
goodness.
So that's Jane Buckley there. Her books, there's a, they're a trilogy plus one.
Yeah.
Stone Corners, three books out now, fourth in the works,
yeah.
And who is to say that, given the organic success, because I think it has to be organic when you're not reliant on million-dollar publishing campaign, promotional campaigns and what have you, it's word of mouth and stuff, maybe they'll end up being picked up and it'll be like the fella that didn't sign the Beatles.
Yeah, exactly. Well, fingers crossed. But I mean, it's a good read, and you know, if you want a really good, so I'm one of those annoying people that sort of see the plot happening. So when I do write, I try to avoid people being able to sense what's coming up, and it seems to have worked.
The lazy way of doing that, and I hope you don't employ it because it's going to be embarrassing, is loads of random red herrings.
Oh, okay.
Have you loads of red herrings?
Not at all. None whatsoever.
I'm about your Miss Marple type.
Yeah. I actually really like Miss Marple, but I can tell straight away what's going to happen. No, there's a few,
even with the red herrings.
Yeah, there's a few things then people have gone, oh my goodness, I didn't see that. It all happens in the last chapter as well. And there are cliffhangers, by the way.
Have you figured out, and very finally, do you have to wrap up stories in book four?
Yes.
Okay, so in other words, if people are halfway through book two or three, because there's nothing worse than when you're interested in a series and it gets cancelled, right? And then you don't know
what
happens.
No. I know exactly what's happening in the last chapter. I've known that from day one, from the first book.
Mm-hmm.
I know exactly where they are. Can't say any more than that. And I know exactly what the last words are going to be, the last sentence.
All right, Jane, listen, it's been lovely chatting to
you. And you, thank you very much.
I wish you nothing but success.
Thank you.
If you can remember to contact Caroline and tell her if Amazon ever give you a reason, because that's really piqued my interest, because it doesn't make any sense, and I don't like things that don't make sense.
You know what, I'll be honest with you, Craig, I'm just going to focus on, you know, finishing the fourth book, and then we'll see what happens. But I'm not going to stress out about it. There's worse things happening in the world than me not being on Amazon, so okay. I'll live with it.
It's all relative, but I get
it. It is, yeah.
I do understand. All right. Thank you very much, Jane Buckley. Check out Stone's Corner or search Jane Buckley Writes, and you'll find out where you can get hold of those copies. Right, so those books. Sinn Féin's health spokesperson is Deputy David Cullinan. He joins us on the programme now. Thanks for taking the call this morning. David, good morning to you.
Good morning, Greg.
Right. We learnt over the weekend that a secret plan to hide the scale of the state's liability for illegal nursing home charges, well, we know it's been revealed now in confidential government records. Your assessment, presumably we can only go by what the whistleblower has released and what has been written about it. Your assessment of what successive governments were involved in?
Well, I have to stress from the outset, Greg, that these are allegations that have been made by a whistleblower. They first appeared in the Mail on Sunday yesterday. And at first reading, obviously, it's deeply troubling and was quite shocking in terms of the allegations which have been made. So just first of all, this goes back to unlawful charges for people in nursing homes from 1970 up to 2005. And this would have predated the Fair Deal scheme. And essentially, the 1970 Health Act would have basically allowed for nursing home care to be provided free. So the state has accepted that these charges were unlawful. The problem is that there was a memo that was referenced in this article yesterday and is part of a package of documentation which was given to the newspaper by this whistleblower. But this memo was prepared by the department, was given to Minister James Riley allegedly in 2011. And again, the allegation in the article in terms of what's in the memo is that there was a secret strategy put in place by the department and by the state to essentially force people to go through the courts. So rather than accept that people had recourse for repayment because of overcharging and for unlawful charges, the state would essentially drag people through the courts. A lot of people who went to court dropped out, over half of them, because of, I would imagine, cost and length of time. And then, of course, there are people who simply wouldn't have the means to go to court. So the central contention in the article and from the whistleblower is that this was a secret covert strategy to essentially drag families through the courts unnecessarily.
And it was only, as part of this strategy, it was only at the point where disclosures were sought that they would then settle quietly.
Yeah, so essentially the point is that the department would have accepted that if any of these cases actually proceeded to court, that the state would lose, and that would set a precedent. So the strategy was to drag it out through the courts, get to a point of discovery, and then settle. But of course, at that point, families would have amassed legal costs. For some families, the process might have taken too long and they simply dropped out. So it was a war of attrition.
And for many families with no resources, they would never have got as far as even having a solicitor to pursue this. And then you would have watched on to see what level of success there was, and people may not have pursued it because they simply didn't have the money to do so. Now, it is also suggested in this article and in these documents that this just wasn't established and that was it. No one else was none the wiser. That this is something that would have come across many senior people's desks over the years, and it would have to have been maintained. If it turns out to be true, there's a lot of people had knowledge of this and didn't seemingly say anything.
Yes, that's exactly it. And if this is true, and you know the facts as we see them in terms of what's reported from this memo don't make for comfortable reading from government. So the first thing that needs to happen is all of these documents need to be published. And there's full disclosure because we all have to see the information for ourselves. So I think we have to make that point first. These are allegations, and the only way to deal with this is to have all of the facts presented and published. But if it is the case that the facts as reported or the allegations as reported are true, then it does implicate several ministers for health, because what it says was that similar memos were also given to other ministers for health, including the Taoiseach when he was Minister for Health, and Simon Harris. Now, again, all of these are allegations. I don't have the full facts. And I think what needs to be done very quickly, which I believe is in the best interest of the department, but also in the best interest of government, but certainly in the best interest of those who were forced through the courts and those maybe who didn't have that opportunity, that all of that information is fully disclosed, that the memo in 2011 that's referenced is published, and any other documentation relevant to this. All of the facts need to be established, need to be disclosed, and we need to be able to see all of this for ourselves. And I've written to the Oireachtas Health Committee yesterday asking that they would write to the HSE seeking all of this information, but it shouldn't take that.
Mm. Now, Leo Varadkar this morning has said he's never received a memo along these lines. He also says that the state never conceded the point that private nursing home charges were covered by medical cards. He went on to say that the way it was presented on Sunday, the real picture is more complex than that. I was never party to devising a legal strategy relating to nursing home charges. Do you accept that?
Well, I don't know is the answer to it. I mean, I was very careful right through this interview and other interviews in saying that these are allegations. These are allegations that surfaced yesterday. Of course, then we're going to have a response to that, and that's fine. The only way for any of us to make up our own mind, and I can't determine at this stage what's fact and what's not, is for us to actually see the documentation. So I think it would be in the interest of the Taoiseach and the current Minister for Health and previous Minister for Health to have this information published for the facts to be out there, because I want to simply establish the facts.
Okay.
I think if we have that memo, we can look at the full context. We can look at exactly what was being proposed. On the face of it, from what we can read, this doesn't read well for government. But I'm also conscious of the fact that I haven't read the memo. I've seen selective parts of it quoted in an article, and the best thing that we can do for everybody, Greg, is for the report to be published.
Okay. Were you aware, did you have any knowledge of anything like this, that this may have been happening, or did anyone raise this issue with you alleging that it was happening before now, before Sunday? Sunday the 1st you heard of this?
Well, I think the whole rationale of the allegation which has been made is that this was covert and this was secret. Mm. And the whole logic of it is that force people to go through the courts.
Yeah, but as an opposition health minister, was this ever raised with you? Have you ever had these allegations furnished to you in any form whatsoever?
No. But I was aware of the Ombudsman report in 2010, which actually raised some of these issues and actually raised concerns in relation to a legal strategy. So we had a very critical Ombudsman report in 2010, which is fact, and which did outline very serious
concerns.
And
did you pursue this since? Like, in other words, as an opposition health spokesperson, is this not something that you should have been pursuing yourself rather than reacting? And we appreciate your accepting our invite, of course, to an article in the newspaper. Do you know what I mean? Is this not the type of stuff that you should be pursuing, especially considering you had knowledge of the Ombudsman's report to ensure what was going on, was it ongoing, and so on and so forth? Not you necessarily as an individual, but certainly as the lead opposition party at this time.
Well, listen, I think that's a fair question in relation to the political system generally. But what I would say is that this memo that we're talking about was given to government only. I had no sight of a memo. I wasn't aware of any legal strategy. The government may say there wasn't any legal strategy. So what we have at the moment, to be fair, Greg, is allegations in a newspaper that need to be substantiated by full disclosure of documentation. Mm. It's only then that we can establish the full facts. The Ombudsman report, by the way, was focused mainly on what happened from 1970 up to 2005, and was making the point that the system knew, that the department knew, that the health boards at the time knew that these charges were unlawful, but continued anyway. It did make reference then to the need for a redress scheme and something different to actually resolve the issue. But I obviously had no information in relation to this memo. I haven't seen it. I've seen selective parts of it quoted, and I want to see it published. So I think it's reasonable for me to treat these, in the first instance, as allegations, and second of all, to seek full disclosure from government.
And there's comments going back, this was raised in it all too long before that, in the early noughties too, where Micheál Martin made comments as it relates to refunds for people who perhaps shouldn't have been charged. So it's going back, you know, over 20 years at this point. Finally, if this, I mean, I know you're choosing your words very carefully, and I understand that, and I actually do respect it in terms of not making conclusions before we know all the facts. But if this is substantiated to any extent, really, at all, that there was a policy, that this did happen, what do you believe the consequences should be? In other words, how big do you think this actually is in terms of the implications for the current government, for example?
Well, if the allegations are true and there was such a legal strategy put in place, I think it has fundamental difficulties for government. And I would go as strong as saying that. I think it would obviously be a huge scandal that government would have to account for. And that obviously is based on whether or not all of the allegations which are made are true. And again, I have to be fair as well in terms of it's a newspaper article. I've read it in detail. I'm aware of the 2010 Ombudsman report. I haven't seen or read the full memo which was referenced in the document. I would want to read it, and I think anybody interested in this story in politics will want to see the full report. And I believe that it's actually in the interest of government for that report to be published. If the allegations are true, they are very, very serious and will have very serious implications for government. And that's the reason why I think the government needs to act very urgently and very quickly and engage in full disclosure.
Okay, listen, thanks for all your time this morning. I'm sure there's quite a few demands on you, so I appreciate it. Deputy David Cullinan, Sinn Féin's health spokesperson.